This is Robert Stark. My guest for today's show is Anne Sterzinger. Hey, Anne, nice having you on the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And you are the author of countless works, Nuesquam, The Talkative Corpse, and A Girl Detectives. But I think before we get to your work, I think a good way to start is let's talk about your background. And so who exactly is Anne Sterzinger for the people in the audience who don't know who you are?
Well, my favorite joke is that I'm the world's largest rodent. People ask me who I am. I kind of identify with rodents, and I guess capybaras might be actually slightly larger than I am, but generally I'm the world's tallest rodent, basically. I'm originally from Wisconsin. I grew up there, kind of taught myself to read when I was about 2.5 years old, or so my parents say. I don't remember it happening. But and then I started reading a lot. I wanted to be a writer since the first time I figured out that people wrote books and they didn't just drop down from the gods. You know, I thought, you know, they just fell down from heaven. And when I found out that people wrote them, that's all I ever wanted to do. But, you know, I figured as a day job, maybe I'd be a journalist, you know, writing for newspapers. And so I put a lot of time and effort and apprenticeship into that while meanwhile working a lot of crappy restaurant jobs. And then, of course.
And you weren't a waitress. You did the behind the scenes work at the restaurant.
Yeah. I was probably too shy, and probably will always be too shy to be a good waitress. I really tried to pretend to be extroverted, but I kind of failed at that, you know. So I wound up washing dishes and bussing tables and being a line cook for quite a few years because nobody tells you when you figure out that books don't just drop down from the gods, that being a writer is just practically the worst job ever, except maybe being a rock and roll drummer. You'll wear yourself very thin for practically nothing, and you'll wind up having weird day job after weird day job, unless you've got a trust fund, obviously, but most of us don't, so you wind up in a lot of weird situations, which, you know, people will tell you that's great to use for writing material, but at a certain point you just kind of feel like I've got enough fucking material, you know, to write from now until the time that I would be 200 years old. How about I, you know, get some rest, right?
So how much is your inspiration from your personal life?
A lot of incidents in personal life are so funny that eventually they have to show up somewhere, but they never show up in the same context that they actually existed in your personal life. So I'd say rough percentage, 45%, but it's always twisted, because if you don't twist it a little bit, you just get too defensive about what you're writing about, you know?
Yeah, I interviewed Andy Nowicki on his latest book, and I had to ask him that question, because obviously his characters, he writes some pretty dark characters.
Yeah, beautifully dark characters, but very dark indeed. And you know, at any time you talk to the guy, he's very pleasant, you know, he'll make dark jokes, but... You know, most people who are a little bit introverted and try to seem pleasant are sometimes probing the dark side inside of their head. And it's not always, you know, we don't set out to be, you know, goth assholes.
Yeah, it's just the stereotype of the high school emo and all that. But the thing with the writers who are introverts, because in their personal lives, they're so nice to people, they end up developing these really sort of a dark alter egos, and that a lot of times they put it into their writing.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. I would say that applies to Andy. I mean, nobody's nice all the time, all the way through. We're all animals. We're all primates, and people who try to be nice, often come up with a lot of really dark fiction. And people who know you read it, and they'll be like, "Jesus, are you an axe murderer in your secret life?"
And the thing with Andy Nowicki, I mean, with him, he's very religious. He's a Christian, so that's something else. I mean, you're totally secular, so you can kind of get a with you're different, but people kind of ex he's like a Christian, so people expect you to be a certain way.
Right. Well, he's, I guess in the United States today, like saying he's Christian, he's actually Catholic. And a lot of so-called Christians don't consider Catholics to actually be Christian, which is the weirdest fucking thing I've ever heard of, but it happens, right?
And you were raised Catholic.
Yeah, I was raised Catholic, and the thing is, it's weird. I had sort of a crisis of faith when I was very young because, a priest said something, just did something horrible at a funeral of a.
He didn't do something horrible in a scandalous way.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
It wasn't the stereotypical
Yeah.
sexual thing. It was my beloved aunt died in a horrible car crash with her 3-month-old baby. And she had spent a lot of her life finding the love of her life, and she finally did when she was 35 years old. Well, no, she found him when she was 30 years old. She died when she was 35. They had a baby. It was kind of a finally she had a fairy book romance. But her husband had been previously married to a woman who was just horrible and just treated him like shit and kind of screwed him in the divorce. And he finally found my aunt, and they fell in love, and it was wonderful for both of them, but he couldn't get his previous marriage annulled. And when he met my aunt, and they fell in love, and they had this wonderful love story, and then she just randomly died, was struck down in a rainstorm by a semi with their 3-month-old baby. The priest at the funeral went out of his way to just drive home the fact that she and the baby were both going to hell because his previous marriage hadn't been annulled. And this guy was just, he was kind of my hero when he was married to my aunt. He was a big, strong, Air Force guy who just got things done and was, the strong, silent type. And I had always really loved my aunt, and he made her so happy. And this priest went out of his way to make this guy cry at her funeral.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of well, I guess a lot of people, someone who is let's say a devout Christian, their response would be there's a lot of assholes in religion. There's a lot of religious figures who are assholes.
Yeah, there's a lot of assholes everywhere, but that kind of set me on a path to questioning. I kind of went off on a long tangent there. I'm sorry that you asked for my personal information and I tell you this horrible story about a funeral and a gory thing.
Yeah,
Sorry.
like we're kind of on a like a silly note, and you tell this horrible tragedy.
Sorry. But I guess the point that I was eventually getting to was, despite the fact that that incident, it's kind of lightening it to call it an incident, but that soured me on the Catholic Church. Coincidentally or not coincidentally, I've always found that my best friends and turn out to be Catholic or raised Catholic, and I don't know how we find each other. I don't want to start a conspiracy theory, but it's a certain ethic of just, examining oneself. Yeah, the stereotype is feeling guilty, but there's a little more behind that. It's not it's hard to explain, but
So you said some interesting things about your work. I listened to one of your other interviews, and you talk about the journalism. Well, are you a proofreader now?
yeah, I mean, I when I was working at the Reader, you probably heard about that. It's the sort of, boilerplate leftist cultural rag in Chicago. It used to be a lot more interesting. Now it's really not. Of course, I'm biased because they don't hire proofreaders anymore. But I started there as a proofreader, and I kind of moved on to being a proofreader slash freelance writer because they paid their proofreaders about $9 an hour, which was a good incentive to get us to write
Yeah.
in our free time. So yeah, I don't think I made it that clear in that interview what exactly I was doing. Were you a journalist? Were you a proofreader? Now I'm just a proofreader at an ad agency because that's the only market for my skills anymore. So
And you said something interesting about the journalism industry. Historically, traditionally, you had a lot of working class men. But now it's dominated by upper middle class women. So even though you're a female, you don't necessarily click with the upper middle class women who dominate the journalism industry.
No, I found them really alienating, really it's odd the splits that go on in people's heads. They were really really self-righteous about being oppressed as women, but it didn't even seem to occur to them that who their parents were and where they went to school and who they met at school and they saw a little this little tiny bit of the equation and decided to focus on that without realizing, like being male or female doesn't that make as much anywhere near as much difference to your success as, growing up, in a northern suburb of Chicago and having all these connections. Since talking about how I was sort of there before that, while that transition was going on, and that, is the kind of thing that rich kids with a high self-esteem and a low expectation of what's going to be expected out of them will fucking pull when they're let run loose, I wasn't particularly surprised, but I was shocked, if that makes any sense. When I first moved to Chicago, I was kind of stunned by the attitudes that some of the women here had, just of I should be worshipped just for being alive. And I'd never heard of anything like that before.
Yeah, and again, I think it's also a class thing.
I mean, when I first moved here, I you know the I worked for I worked for a restaurant for a while, and then I just responded to an ad in the Reader, and they hired me because, I had really good proofreading skills, and they needed people to be able to do that. But they didn't feel comfortable with me. I didn't feel comfortable with them because they had this kind of like, we're the girls, we're the girls' team, and we
You
all toe the
probably
party
thought
line, and
they were,
I
yeah,
just
you probably
kind of
thought they
went.
were total cunts.
Thanks for reading my mind and saying what I was afraid to say, but
Yeah. And the whole sort of you don't talk as much about politics, but yeah, the whole sort of left-wing blogosphere, it's sort of dominated by those kind of people.
I guess I would have to say that there's a lot of even upper middle class women of color will pull the same thing, and they have two excuses for being rich basically, and it's really interesting what people will choose to see and not see. And not surprisingly, they'll choose to see what's holding them back as opposed to what's sort of pushed them up.
Yeah, 'cause the le I think historically, the left was, in the left you had this, like even among communists it was always like the masculine image of the sort of working class male, and that was the old left, and the left today is kind of, it's upper. upper class people with the sort of identity politics, like women and, or you, as you pointed out, you like you have a like a black female from an upper middle class background who benefits from affirmative action. Like that's the example of that.
Right, and you know, I'm not black, so I don't know what she's gone through of like, you know, cab drivers passing her by even though she has money. You know, there's obviously a point to be made there.
Maybe you get cab drivers passing you down for different reasons.
Or I just don't hail a cab driver because I don't have any money. I think I've hailed a cab driver maybe 3 times in my life. Usually I'm just getting on public transit, you know.
Or they can't get into the country club. Maybe there's racial discrimination in a country club, like in the past, country clubs did discriminate on race, and that's true. But most of us can't afford to get in a country club.
Exactly. Well, not that I'm interested in golf, but yeah, there. The thing is, if you'd asked me 70 years ago, if I was a liberal, I would have said, well, of course, because you know that sort of end of the political spectrum was more focused on issues of class and money and where are you coming from? And I think you're right. It's moved on to more, I don't want to say boutique issues because, like I said, I've never been called an N-bomb. I've never experienced that, so I can't dismiss it.
You've never been called any racial slur.
Oh yeah, I have. I've obviously been called racial slurs. Everyone has. That happens to people. People are naturally xenophobic. We're primates. You don't like, you know, the monkey from that tribe over there.
Are you from a working class background?
Yeah.
So with economic, yeah, with the economic issues, issues like, and I agree with you. I mean, like, I personally think we should raise taxes on billionaires. So in that.
Actually, I actually have a wacky theory. I think no one who makes under, say, $500,000 a year should pay any income taxes at
I
all.
totally agree, yeah.
Because, you know, the people who are making a real profit off of society are and who are using the roads and make, you know, if you're making $1 million, you can pay for the roads, okay? The rest of us are already paying tolls anyway, if you live in Illinois. Yeah, I mean those people can afford to pay for the society that they're benefiting so richly from. Anybody under $500,000 a year, you know, you get on public transit or you hop in your car every morning. You work, you work, you work, you work. You go home, you've already paid your taxes by having somebody take money off the top of your labor. I mean, I don't want to get fired, but I've seen the invoices of what my company gets to charge their clients for my labor, and then I see what I get paid an hour. I've already been taxed, okay? Why am, you know?
So what's your take on the billionaires and the people making like a hundred million, those people?
Way to go, dude. You know, how about you pay some taxes? I mean, that actually sounds a bit idiotic. I've had a long day.
Yeah.
Yeah. My take on it is, maybe you're smarter than I am. Maybe you're luckier than I am. But, well, the thing is, that kind of thing didn't exist 50 years ago. You know,
Yeah, I mean
CEOs.
the nine. It's funny because conservatives really love to idealize the 1950s, but one thing about the 1950s is there really you didn't have tons of billionaires back then. I mean, if
Right.
anything, I think the tax rates for the ultra rich were much higher. So if conservatives are going to idealize that era, then they have to look at that issue.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to live in the libertarian paradise where we just, pay $10 for our police service and that's it. But in a country this size, we have to have roads, we have to have all this other bullshit. Somebody's got to pay for it.
Yeah, so I guess we can move on to the topic of antinatalism. And I like you describe your coinage, you describe human beings, you call them flesh puppets.
I kind of
Did
stole
you
that,
coin that?
not
You stole it,
intellectually.
okay.
I did coin that, but I kind of stole it from Thomas Ligotti's idea of us as just sort of puppets of the force of DNA, the force of evolution, or whatever you want to call it. His fiction is really interesting in that he has sort of a rationalistic belief in, we are just DNA, we are just evolution. But really, something sneaks into his fiction that ties into this idea that there might be a mind behind the universe, but it's not the good, pleasant, God that we want to be there. It might actually have it in for us. And yeah, the phrase meat, well, actually, the meat puppets were a band from Milwaukee in the 1980s, I think. But flesh puppets, that whole idea that we're just sort of, and obviously, I don't subscribe wholeheartedly to that, because no one could for more than 30 seconds without winding up in a straitjacket.
Yeah, are you kind of, there is this radical environmentalist name from Finland named Pentti Linkola, and he's like he's coming from it from an ecological standpoint, but I mean he like celebrates things like the Holocaust and the communist the Bolshevik mass murder of millions of people because he wants to see humanity just dwindle down to a couple million people.
Wow, well, that's a pretty bloody way to think of it.
And you wouldn't say stuff. You wouldn't obviously would not. You support reducing the human population not through genocide, but through telling people not to have kids. Antinatalism.
Right. I mean, if genocide is harmful, it makes people suffer. But just not procreating, nobody's harmed. I think David Benatar, who wrote "Better Not to Have Been," he had a nice, chart of symmetry laid out. If you're born and your life is great, that's good. But your parents don't know how your life is going to go, no matter how much money they have or whatever. I mean, you could wind up being Lena Dunham, even if your parents are rich, right? So, no matter what you think is going to happen to your kid, bad things could happen. They could have Down syndrome. They could wind up trapped in a tunnel for 3 days before they die horribly of starvation. They could become paraplegic. But if that child is never created, then there's nobody around to suffer not being there. And that's David Benatar's sort of asymmetry. If a person is created, they can have a good life, which is good. They can have a bad life, which is terrible. And so when you're rolling the dice on someone else's behalf, you don't want to just look at the good. You want to look at, well, something really horrible could happen to them that would negate anything I might be able to do for them. Whereas if you don't have a child at all, nobody exists, nobody's harmed because that person doesn't exist yet or ever, and no harm, no foul. I was going to say, obviously, I'm of two minds about it. Any human being has an instinct to want to leave a legacy, and if the human race dies out, obviously none of us will leave a legacy at all. Arguably, the human race is going to die out no matter what we do, because the sun will eventually go supernova, and our chances of getting to other solar systems are, you know, looking pretty grim unless we invent a warp drive.
So yeah, you know what is his name? The guy Chip, I forget his last name from Nine Banded Books.
Chips. Yeah, Chip Smith.
Yeah, he was interviewed.
Yeah, yeah.
He did a written.
I've corresponded.
He did a written interview with Greg Johnson here on Countercurrents, and Greg Johnson's coming at it from a very different standpoint. Greg Johnson is obviously not an antinatalist. His whole thing is he wants white people to have more kids because whites are being overrun by non-whites. But his point in their discussion, he said to Chip about antinatalism, his point is the kind of people who get into antinatalism are the sort of high IQ, intellectual, deep-thinking kind of people. And then you get all the sort of stupid, irresponsible people who have lots of kids, or people have lots of kids, or you get religious fanatics who turn out 10 kids. So the kind of the counter article against antinatalism is that the kind of people who buy into antinatalism are a sort of higher caliber people, and the people who have kids, those are the kind of people who are going to dominate a society and kind of run humanity. What is your response to that argument?
We've all seen the movie Idiotocracy.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly. That's where we're headed.
And it's a really grim prospect. And you know, realistically, I can't stop everyone from breeding.
Because they're pro natalist. Is that the main thing?
Well, yeah, they're pro breeding white babies, and you know, in a way, I get the fact that Europe is being colonized, and I don't like that. I don't like the fact that, you know, it's okay for one kind of colonization to exist and another kind of colonization to not exist. And that, you know, that's a really real gut level feeling. But at the same time, it's like, why would I breed more suffering humans? You know, because the tribal warfare is just going to go on and on and on. And the ethnocentrist ideal of having everybody separate, not bugging the shit out of each other, is great, but the world's not that big and everybody wants to have more babies. So where are you going to put all these little ethnocentrist states? It's a great idea, but just like communism, which sounds like a great idea, I don't know how or where or on what planet you're going to do this.
Your first book that came out is it Nuesquam, or did Girl Detectives come out first?
Well, Girl Detectives came out as a POD on Amazon when PODs were a new thing, so it was ridiculously expensive and no one could buy it.
So I guess we can start off with Nuesquam, and that is Latin for nowhere. And I think the thing about it we can talk about is where it takes place. And it takes place in southern Illinois. And you got inspiration from visiting there, or did you actually live there?
I actually lived there. I went to school there. I was kind of following a journalism apprenticeship track through my 20s, and that fell through just because newsprint fell through, and I decided to get a degree in something I was interested in, which probably was a mistake. But there were good classics professors in Southern Illinois, and also it was really cheap to study abroad. So, in and out, I think I lived there about 3 years.
So, what about the place inspired you to write the book? I mean, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as a really depressing, really isolated college town. And what inspired me to write the book was just thinking about how much worse my life could be if I were trying to raise a kid there. And logically, that would have made me a man, and that wound up as the protagonist of the book.
So are you trying to say that the protagonist is a male version of yourself?
Not really. In a sense, yes, but it was more the what I imagined a man who was in a much different position than I was, in the same physical, you know, geographical space than I was, would react to situations that would never happen to me. The setup of the plot came from my thinking about a lot of variables that just logically wound up being the character that it was. And then
so are the overall themes of the book?
Kind of what happens when dreams die and people get stuck in the reality of real life, and they get stuck in, you know, maybe some manipulative things that people that they love do.
Are you saying when people are young, they have this fantasy of what their life will be? When people reach a certain age, they hit a point where they realize that their life is not going, they're not going to achieve their fantasy, and their life basically sucks, and it's going to suck for the rest of their life. Is that basically what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's a really good way to sum it up. And I think one of the reasons that people have these fantasy lives when they're young, or at least that I did, is that none of the choices that are presented to you really seem very noble or worthy. You know, either you can be a loser or you can work in advertising, or and people think, well, you know, maybe instead I'll be a rock star or a writer. And even if that were possible for the average person, what does that mean anyway?
And, I mean, I have not read a Nuesquam, but I am reading, I'm just starting to read The Talkative Corpse, and it's definitely the same, a very similar theme in The Talkative Corpse, but I guess I will, well, before we move on to The Talkative Corpse, is there anything you'd like to add about Nuesquam that the audience should know about?
I guess it's a very, very dark book. But I like it.
So I'm starting The Talkative Corpse just maybe about a quarter of the way through. And the character, it's basically the talkative corpse. It's about a there's some archaeologist thousands of years from now, and he finds the writings of a man who lives basically in our time, or from the year 2011. And it takes place in Chicago, where you are. But I guess one of the reviews I read, it's kind of it talks about what is it like to be a loser, the theme of loserdom. And I think it's in if you look in Hollywood, there is this kind of the Hollywood concept of a loser is like a guy who plays in a shitty band, or it's someone whose rich parents sends them off to rehab for a drug addiction. And I'm reading that is what the Matt Forney review of your book says. But there is basically this man, John Jago, and he basically is he has like a minimum wage job at age 40, and he doesn't have any friends. And it really starts off he talks about the way he looks at the world and his outlook. And I guess that's my take on it from where I'm starting. I'm just starting the book, but what would you like to add on that?
What Matt said about, you know, the Hollywood view of loserdom was very interesting. The Hollywood view of loserdom is the little tiny slice of pain that happens to people who have access to that kind of world. That's their little slice of slumming.
Yeah, it's kind of the people in Hollywood, they write stuff based on their life, on their experience. Yeah. They don't understand what it's like for someone who's basically on the very bottom of society. And it's too, and they don't want to write about it, but I think because most your writings and Andy Nowicki's writings, I think you have a niche audience, and I don't necessarily mean that as a bad thing. I think that's actually a good thing, but Hollywood is catering to your average person, and your average person doesn't want something that's too depressing.
Well, the reason your average person doesn't want something that's too depressing is because their life is already fucking depressing enough.
What inspires you to sort of write about these people whose lives are very, very kind of depressing?
Well, I guess in a little perverse turn on the, you know, Iowa school dictum, write what you know, what I know is mostly people whose lives are horribly depressing. And most of them / us turn to these pretty fictions, or actually to some people they are realities that Hollywood creates. And, unfortunately, what gets mass produced is what gets mass consumed. And that used to be more meritocratic, more, I guess, proto-capitalist, you would call it. But the machination of distribution has become so unequal. And also, there are so many people on the planet. I mean, out of 7 billion people, how many of them want to be writers? And what slice, you know, if there's this huge competition to have your voice heard, if you've already got access to this huge piece of machinery, of course you're going to be heard, and that's going to snowball. So real losers are going in droves to see movies or read books about fake losers, which is kind of a huge tragedy. And I guess I'm trying to chisel away at that a tiny bit. I don't know how successful I'll be. Probably not very.
And I guess other example, obviously Andy Nowicki's character, a lot of his characters are the same way.
Pardon?
A lot of Andy Nowicki's characters in his books are similar in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of his characters are very similar to mine. We both started writing characters like that long before we met each other. So, you know, it's not like he's ripping me off or I'm ripping him off. It's just we happen to come from a similar place and time.
So, how would you describe John Jago? How would you describe his personality?
He's somewhat justifiably bitter. You know, he's not had the greatest time. I don't know if you've read up to this point, but in his job at the pizza restaurant, he's being called a phone girl, and his job is a minimum.
That part, yeah.
Yeah, and actually, Matt Forney asked me this, and I didn't answer it, not because I was trying to evade the question. You only evade questions when they're asking you, Senator, did you embezzle the funds? I just got off on a tangent. But I actually did, for a while in my 30s, a couple of years ago, have a job as a phone girl at a pizza restaurant, and there was a male phone girl that they called phone girl. And yes, the owner did steal our wages.
Yeah, so it is the character, he's constantly humiliated.
Yeah, he's constantly humiliated, and he's, you know, he is made up of part me, but he's also made up of part people I, you know, observed, like this guy who, you know, was obviously doing a job that he was too smart for, and could have been doing a better job, but that's where he wound up at that place and time, and everyone thought it was fucking hilarious to call him a girl.
And the thing about the character, he's not like a total, he's not an idiot. He's actually has a fairly high intellect.
Yeah, I mean,
that makes him feel more humiliated than if he was an idiot.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely more humiliated than he would be if he was an idiot. And that's, I don't know. Have you been in the job market lately?
I have, but nothing, not like that. I mean, what I've had.
What's that?
I have been in the job market, but I haven't really done it. I haven't done a job like that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, with the recession and the wars and whatnot, there are a lot of people who are doing jobs that are way below their intellect, and part of that is just because the job market is so tight.
And the other,
but another part of, hello?
Okay, go ahead.
Part of that is because the job market is so tight, but another part of that is because a lot of jobs that really smart people used to do just disappeared all of a sudden. I've talked about this before. The newspaper industry just disappeared. Encyclopedias just disappeared. Libraries are cutting, you know. And all of a sudden, all these very intelligent, not very socially adept people, are
the kind of people who are high intelligence but very introverted.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what?
Another
thing this reminds me of is some of the spree shooters, like the college student who shot up the theater in Aurora, Colorado. They do fit that category. That spree
shooter was
very, very intelligent, but he was also very much isolated and introverted.
Yeah. I mean, that's a type of personality that's, you know, could be useful to society, but isn't particularly valued by the way society has gone. I don't know how you would fix that, but unfortunately, some of them are shooting people.
And because there's a debate between, well, there is a debate. There are genuine losers, and then there's situational losers. I think genuine losers, they kind of come to accept their fate. But situational losers tend to be really pissed off because they have this sense that they deserve better than their current existence.
I think that's an interesting distinction, but I think maybe a lot of people float between those two. I know I do. Sometimes I just think, well, you know, evolution is not selecting for introverts right now. I'd better code coupons for 12 hours a day. And other times I think I'm going to slit somebody's throat.
And I know this in one part of the book is there is a reference to antinatalism because it's not politically correct to hate kids. Everyone has to say how much they love the children. But I know there's a scene where he talks about the customers and how they bring in their kids. So you do, you bring in a little bit of your antinatalism into the book.
Well, I can't help it. I mean, if nobody had kids, we wouldn't have any problems. That's a really flippant way of putting it. But bringing a person into the world is a very, very serious moral consideration. And a lot of people don't really think about it before they do it. And then they, you know, your classic welfare queen has a kid when she doesn't have a job. And what happens next? Who knows?
Yeah, and you don't want. I don't want to go off on some political tangent, but it's interesting.
No, neither do I. But I'm just saying that's an extreme example of people just like, I'm just gonna have a kid and I'm not gonna think about it.
I kind of want to make a brief comment that there's no social safety net really for single people who don't have kids or are not retired. They get absolutely nothing.
You know. No, that's a really interesting point because I was thinking about that a lot when I was writing that book. Have you ever noticed how many more male panhandlers there are than female panhandlers?
Yeah, most of them are because they can't have kids.
Yeah, they can't be a single mom. They can't apply for welfare, and if they can't find a job, that's all they can do. I mean, and I'm not a man, but I don't have kids. And I had, you know, I'd paid into the system my whole life. And for a couple of years there, when I couldn't find a job except for one that was way below my skill level with kids half my age, I couldn't get a month off on the benefits that I'd paid into my whole life to look for a job because I didn't have a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And what is the role of sexuality in the book?
Well, John's problem isn't so much sexuality; it's sexuality mixed with love. He doesn't just want a girl; he wants to be in love. And the ex-girlfriend that he has in the book, he was very much in love with, and she kind of pissed on that. In order to, you know, sort of try to marry up. Sorry for the spoilers. She tried to marry up and kind of failed. He winds up feeling sort of sorry for her. But in my writing, sexuality is very much mixed up with love because I think for anyone who's a functioning human being, the two are mixed up.
And so she originally loved him, but she chose someone else who had more money, even though she loved him, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you don't want to give away too much of the plot, but he has a dilemma later on. Do you want to let the audience know about what happens later on in the plot, or do you want to keep it a secret?
Yeah, he, well, to be I hope, enticingly vague. He eventually, events continue to conspire to make him more angry. He almost gets a really good job, but he gets mugged 2 days into it and is hospitalized. And he's hospitalized for so long that he loses his new good job, which, yes, that is autobiographical. That did happen to me. I found a job, and then I was mugged by somebody who came up from me from behind. I never even saw them. And put me in the hospital for 5 days. And, yeah, I will admit that part is autobiographical. It was pretty much too good not to go in a book.
Yeah.
Once I'd been through it. But anyway, events like that continue to conspire to make him angrier and angrier, to the point where he gets blacked out drunk on Halloween and wakes up the next day and realizes that his anger over his economic situation and his fickle ex-girlfriend and just his general beef with reality conspired to make him Google revenge and the occult. And he has somehow conjured a demon, or a sort of sub-demon, who doesn't have the powers of a real demon, but can offer him sort of a horrible deal, in which the demon will kill someone he hates, but also kill someone he loves. And the rest of the book sort of hinges on him trying to figure out who he hates and loves and what hate is and what love is and how many people he hates. And sorry, spoilers.
Oh, okay. Hold on a second. I forgot to ask a question. One thing about it is you write a lot of male characters. Usually, in general, women writers cannot write male characters, but you actually do a really good job at it, which is very extremely rare.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really glad to succeed in that in any way. The first male protagonist I wrote was in Nusquam, and he logically had to be male to fit the plot. And I found that it was a really excellent challenge. And empathy is kind of a drug.
This is a kind of a personal question, but do you get along better with men or women?
Okay. When girls say this, this always comes off as, I'm too pretty, so all the girls hate me. But in my case, it's more like I kind of have Tourette's, so all the girls are weirded out by me. But yes, I definitely get along better with men.
Yes, that's probably why you're good at writing those roles. So I think we covered a lot. So I'd like to thank Anne Sturzinger for being on.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.